This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Is bulk data collection for not just the United States, but for all these other countries around the world.
James Bamford, I want to read a quote about the NSA and its domestic surveillance apparatus that you use at the end of your piece in the New York Review of Books. It's from late Senator Frank Church, 1975. He said, quote, "That capability at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left. Such is the capability to monitor everything. Telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide. If this government ever became a tyranny, if a dictator ever took charge in this country, the technological capacity that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose total tyranny, and there would be no way to fight back, because the most careful effort to combine together in resistance to the government, no matter how privately it was done, is within the reach of the government to know. Such is the capability of this technology. I don't want to see this country ever go across the bridge. I know the capacity that is there to make tyranny total in America, and we must see to it that this agency and all agencies that possess this technology operate within the law and under proper supervision so that we never cross over that abyss. That is the abyss from which there is no return." Those the words of the late Senator Frank Church in 1975, who convened the Church Committee hearings to challenge this level of total surveillance. And that's the quote that Jim Bamford ends his piece with in the New York Review of Books. I want to thank you both for being with us for this hour. James Bamford, investigative reporter who's covered the National Security Agency for three decades, helped expose the NSA's existence in the 80s. His most recent book, The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. His most recent piece in the New York Review of Books, They Know Much More Than You Think. And thanks so much to Spencer Ackerman, National Security Editor at The Guardian. We'll link to your piece as well. It's called U.S. Government Declassifies Court Order on NSA Surveillance as Pressure Builds. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge with host Joanne Hardesty. Today's guest is Helen Gilbert, spokesperson for the Free Marissa Alexander Now campaign. Alexander is a survivor of domestic violence who was sentenced to 20 years in prison for trying to defend herself against her aggressor. Apparently, stand your ground laws do not apply to women, especially women of color.
KBOO Community Radio and Veterans for Peace Chapter 72 are proud to co-sponsor a special presentation on Thursday, August 1st at 6:30 p.m. An insider's account of Guantanamo will examine the illegality, immorality, and inhumanity of the U.S. Naval Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, with Stephen T. Wax, Chief Federal Public Defender for the District of Oregon, Laura Sandown, a U.S. Navy veteran who served at Guantanamo, and S. Brian Wilson, a longtime peace activist, among others. An insider's account of Guantanamo will take place at the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue in downtown Portland. Thursday, August 1st, doors open at 6:30 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good people, stay tuned every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. for Guess Who's Coming to Radio, a show with music and discussion addressing socio-political issues relevant to African peoples in this nation. We encourage you to call in with some positive, proactive solutions to what we are facing today. Guess Who's Coming to Radio, every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. on KBOO, your community radio.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Good morning, good morning, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. I am Joanne Hardesty, and it's my pleasure today to have as my guest Helen Gilbert. Helen Gilbert is part of the leadership core of the Pacific Northwest Alliance to Free Melissa Alexander and the National Free Marissa Noun Campaign. Ms. Gilbert is the Seattle organizer for Radical Women, a national multiracial socialist feminist organization that fights for women's rights and social justice. For my listening audience, first let me welcome to the studio Helen Gilbert. Good morning, Helen. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks for doing this show.
You are very welcome. And so I thought before we jumped in, because you and I are kind of experts in this case from all the reading that I've seen, I'd like to kind of set the stage for my listening audience. And so for people who may not know, in August of 2010, Marissa fired a single warning shot in the ceiling to halt her abusive partner during a threatening beating at her home. Marissa's husband, who has previously landed Marissa in the hospital after beating her, admitted in a sworn statement that he was the aggressor and threatened her life. Despite this fact that Marissa had caused no injuries, the Florida's self-defense law, including right to stand your ground, she was arrested by Jacksonville police, charged with aggravated assault, and sentenced to 20 years in the Florida criminal corrections system. And so, again, welcome, Helen. So I will stop the story there and allow you to pick it up for me. Marissa went to trial.
Yes, she went to trial, and her sentencing occurred last May, just when the world was riveted by the murder of Trayvon Martin, and marches were occurring to demand the arrest of George Zimmerman, who was hiding behind Stand Your Ground law. Right. And practically that same week, Marissa Alexander was sentenced to 20 years, and we learned how she had been denied the ability to have a stand-your-ground self-defense plea. And this mother of three is serving a sentence. She's been in jail now for 3 years and had attempted recently to be released on bond while her case is under appeal and was denied that. So it's just a horrible injustice that we feel is, the whole interconnections of racism and mm-hmm. sexism and political prison industrial complex right. are focusing on this one woman.
And certainly her case represents the idea of mandatory minimum sentencing, because the judge said that once the jury convicted her, there was no choice for the judge but to sentence her to 20 years because Florida has a 10-20 life law.
Yes, and these mandatory minimum sentences are a real big problem and part of the reason why we are seeing such mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that federal courts do not allow mandatory minimums. And the problem with Florida is it has like 7 pages worth of specific crimes and mandatory mandatory sentencing. And they say, nothing is taken into account. So right. self-defense, a pattern of abuse, the fact no one was injured
right.
has no bearing, and this is ridiculous.
Well, and as a member of the public, there's no, of course you're going to compare this case to the George Zimmerman case, especially since the prosecutor was the exact same prosecutor.
Right.
And so the difference between the aggressive, zealot nature of the prosecution for Marissa Alexander as compared to public pressure, having to force the same prosecutor to even charge George Zimmerman, I mean, that it seems obvious to me. I don't know how obvious that is to most of the public.
Yeah, well, Angela Corey is the state prosecutor, and it is really clear that the policy in these cases came from her. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a random way that the state handled these two cases. And Jacksonville activists, Florida activists in the new Jim Crow movement and Southern Freedom Movement, they're demanding the firing of Angela Corey and Freedom for Marissa Alexander, because they see definitely that Angela Corey represents a policy that is discriminatory and that is going after people of color and in a very discriminatory way. A lot of people feel that the way that they handled the Trayvon Martin case was set up to fail. Their heart wasn't in actually defending Trayvon Martin against the smears in that case. Yet in Marissa Alexander's case, they were hell-bent to put her behind bars.
Well, what I find interesting is that she had a restraining order against her partner, and he violated that restraining order, which means he actually should have been, and he should have been the one incarcerated.
Yeah, well, there's some intricacies of what was happening exactly that day. That the case is under appeal, and we can't go into a lot. But they had just had a baby. She had only had a baby, I believe, 9 days before the incident.
That's
so
what
obviously
I read, right.
She was in an extremely vulnerable position.
Right.
And during the time at one point the restraining order had been put on hold, although the fact that it had existed certainly, and that she'd been hospitalized by his attacks in the past certainly shows, you know, what he was capable of.
And so, is Marissa Alexander's case rare? I mean, is this an anomaly, or are you finding that women, especially women of color who are suffering domestic violence, end up being incarcerated?
I think this is just one instance of many, many cases. What's been happening is that women tend to be the ones criminalized in domestic violence situations, and women of color in particular. The stereotypes against them, both the racist and sexist stereotypes of when women stand up for themselves, they suddenly stop being victims that courts are sympathetic to, and they start to be seen as aggressors. And for women of color in particular, those stereotypes of, oh, she's an angry woman, she's criminal, she's violent, really come into play. And there's other cases. In general, women of color are denied a lot of the services, and or the services are not very available to them that are open to other domestic violence, people fleeing domestic violence. And the system is really failing them. Also, when we're seeing the cuts in services, the cuts in funding to family services, counseling for families with serious problems, child care services, and jobs. And all these things are the kind of safety net that allow women to get out of physically or mentally abusive situations without being in danger.
Right. So, Helen, I'm going to let folks know that if you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 503-231-8187. I am talking to Helen Gilbert, and she is part of the leadership core of the Pacific Northwest Alliance to Free Marissa Alexander and the National Free Marissa Now campaign. And it's a pleasure to have you here this morning. We do have a caller on the line. Good morning, Joanne. Welcome to KBOO.
Yeah, hello. My daughter and grandchildren still haven't healed from their domestic violence. In fact, my daughter's had a Social Security number stolen 3 times, the last time just recently. And I belonged to Radical Woman for a short time years ago, but, you know, I wasn't a real member. But anyway, the reason why I'm calling, I want to say I love you and others that are helping women like this, and I wish you all well, and that's all I can do. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you
very much.
Appreciate the call. 503-231-8187. And so as we continue to talk, Helen, this is really a very multi-layered problem. But Marissa Alexander's case definitely gives us the opportunity to really unpack this. And so you were talking just before we went to the call about this cut and services that actually support women and their children to get out of these violent home situations, because these are being cut at the state and federal level. They're limited services, but even those services that are available, many are not culturally competent. And so they don't provide services to people where they are in a way that makes sense for them. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, that is a serious problem, yeah.
And so how did we end up, I know there's a lot of reasons how we ended up with this disconnect from what's supposed to be happening, which is a woman who has gone to the same court system to say, protect me from this person. That same court system then turns around and gives her a 20-year mandatory minimum sentence. There seems to be such a disconnect there.
Yeah, well, as a friend of mine said, U.S. society really values women who stand by their man a lot more than they value women who stand up to their man.
That's a really good point. I like that. I'm gonna keep that one. All of us around the country have been impacted, especially communities of color and poor communities, by mandatory minimums all across the country. In Oregon, we have a one strike, you're out law. I know you live in Seattle, and there used to be a time in Seattle that it was almost impossible to vote after you got out of prison or being incarcerated. And I understand that's changed a bit in Washington State.
Well, in Washington, we have 3 strikes, which is a terrible law. Mm-hmm. And supposedly in Washington, you can get your civil rights, voting rights back. But when I looked into it, mm-hmm. after talking to ex-convicts who said, well, they could not vote, I found that the road to actually gaining those rights back is so tortuous and difficult that very, very few can do that because it's so hard to get a job or get, you know, decent employment if you have a prison record.
Right.
And part of this thing that the requirements are paying back huge fines and
yes.
all this restitution and then going back to court, which may not be all that
pleasant,
welcoming to
right.
someone who's been through the system. So it's a very difficult process. So on paper, people have the possibility, but in reality, it's not very open.
Well, thank you for clarifying that for me, because that's as bad as it was the last time I was doing voter education in Washington State. I thought, but somebody told me recently that the law had changed to make it easier. And so that, because what happened was you have to apply to the prosecutor that prosecuted you. And they must be okay with it. Then you go in front of the judge. He has to be okay with it. Then it goes to this office that has an up or down vote, a one person office that has an up or down vote. And as you said, you have to pay all the fines, the restitution, back child support, et cetera, et cetera. And that's normally, if you've been in jail for mandatory minimums, that's normally a significant amount of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have another caller on the line. Hello, Sherelle. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, hello, Joanne.
Good morning.
Always love your show.
Thank you.
I love what you do and the people that call in and your guest. And your guest here is just, this is so important. I just wanted to say, I'm a woman of significant Native American descent, and a situation occurred where a neighbor was visiting another neighbor, a Native American woman was visiting a Native American man. And I wasn't acquainted with these people. But anyway, a stranger to them came up and started menacing them with a knife and literally chased the woman up onto the steps with a knife and was threatening the whole neighborhood. And when the police came, they did not take this person in. And when I was insistent, saying, why don't you take him in? He's frightening everyone. Please
mm-hmm.
take him away. They said, we'll take you in.
So, whoa.
And I shut up. Because, that's just an instance where it's difficult, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. So solidarity to all women out there, all women.
Well, thank you for sharing that story. It sounds like it's still painful to you. I have one question. Did you file a complaint against that police officer?
No, I didn't. And later on, something occurred with that neighbor because he was really super, super crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And they did take him in. And they returned him, probably because the jail was full. But when they pulled up, they were laughing. So that's what happened there. And but all of this is an issue at large for women because, you know, we are, you know, our hearts maybe are a little too tender. We kind of need to start toughening up, and we need to stand together, that's for sure.
Well, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it.
Well, happy to call you. Let you go then.
All right. Bye-bye. Have a great day. Thank you. We appreciate it. We feel the love. 503-231-8187. I'm speaking with Helen Gilbert, and she's one of the organizers of the Free Marissa Now campaign. If you go to either KBOO's website, Voices from the Edge, or to our Facebook page, you can click on to the Facebook page and get additional information. So, Helen, you live in Seattle. Please tell our listening audience how you got involved in this campaign.
Well, I first heard about Marissa's case at the time of the Trayvon Martin protests a year ago, and a stark contrast between how Zimmerman was being handled with kid gloves and Marissa Alexander locked up was just so appalling. So in Radical Women, we really felt this was an attack on every woman's right to self-defense and started working with other women in the community to educate and put pressure on the Florida system to release her. And through that organizing, we did some great things, like we hung a big banner over the freeway during rush hour, and we spoke at our Martin Luther King Day celebration at a workshop there and helped co-sponsor a Mother's Day parade and march called Take Action for Women and Kids Now. And through this organizing, we met national women who were equally passionate about the need for justice in Marissa Alexander's case. And through that work, we formed the Free Marissa Now, which is a Facebook page and a Tumblr page and a Gmail address, so people can contact us easily if you look for Free Marissa Now. And we've been pulling people together from all over the world. There's, I think, been about 20 different countries that have, people from 20 countries that have given their support on the Facebook comments, and a growing list of endorsers. We're hoping that all civil rights, feminist, anti-domestic violence organizations and unions will step forward to support this woman.
Wonderful.
And we're also doing a letter-writing campaign to Marissa, so people could visit the Facebook page or the Tumblr page and get her address, because we want to show her that she has huge support and we are determined to get her out of prison.
You know, I'm so glad to hear that there seems to be efforts taking place on multi-levels. And as you were talking, it occurs to me that the impact of having a Congress who's been having a full court press attack on women, at least for the last few years. And so as I think about all the legislation, all the anti-women legislation that continues to move through Congress, I can't help but think that there's a connection to this other end, which is women who are experiencing domestic violence, that that there's a connection there, that all of a sudden it's easier and safer to be aggressive against women. Because after all, if the folks in Congress can stand up and say the stupid stuff they say about women, then in the local neighborhood, it becomes safer to do that.
Well,
what do you think about
that?
That's a
good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think a lot of these attitudes do convey, come through the legislator, the senator who said, real legitimate rape victims
don't
get pregnant.
That's right, right.
The judge in this case basically said legitimate domestic violence victims don't fight back. And that if Marissa had really been an abused woman, She would have jumped out a window. She would have somehow found a way to get out of that house without firing a shot.
Wow.
And again, it's this very patronizing view that right. everybody in the world knows best what this woman should have done when she's in fear of her life.
Right, right. Oh, and I think the part that most people, once they learn, become really appalled about is the 12-minute jury.
Mm-hmm.
The jury was out for 12 minutes. How do you even review the testimony in 12 minutes? That was the most, as many things about this case makes me crazy, that was the one that put me over the top.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that makes it just appear it was a railroad.
And do you have any idea what the jury makeup was?
I don't. It'd be very interesting to find out, especially
in light of, I
learned recently it was another one of these six-person juries.
Mm-hmm. I just find it amazing that they can have six people can make decisions like that.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, it takes more people than that. Normally, it's like 10 or 12 for a jury. So that, I got to tell you, boy, I'm glad I don't live in Florida.
On many levels.
On many, many levels. So the number to call if you want to join the conversation is 503-231-8187. And so there was a march. There was a south-to-south march last weekend. Can you tell us a bit about that march in support of Marissa?
Sure. This is very exciting. And one of the core members of Free Marissa Now is Alita Alston Touré, who is just a dynamite organizer in Jacksonville, where Marissa Alexander is from, and where Jordan Davis was another case of a young black man murdered in cold blood by a white man who pled self-defense. And they started with a march and rally in Jacksonville, 1,500 people who went to the jail and where Marissa Alexander was located at that moment, and went to Angela Corey's office and demanded release of Marissa and the firing of Angela Corey. And then they started on a 5-day march from Jacksonville to Sanford and marching about 10 miles a day, and then stopping at towns where, you know, historic battles in the civil rights movement had happened, and being greeted by communities and community centers, staying at churches. And they said, I believe, about over the 5 days, about 150 to 200 people participated in this walk. And so it's a very inspiring action for all of us that people are really resisting this in Florida, in Marissa Alexander's hometown, and calling for the firing of the prosecutor, Angela Corey, and freedom for Marissa Alexander.
Wow. Well, that sounds like that was a wonderfully inspiring event, the walk and the organizing that took place around that. If you'd like to join us in the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. So what's next, Helen? What are the immediate plans for the future, and how can people get involved if they'd like to help?
People should contact Free Marissa Now, either through our Facebook page, which has that name, or through our Gmail account, which is freemarissanow@gmail.com. We have teams of people working in different areas, people who are interested in social outreach, in arts, faith community, people who want to work in the domestic violence, getting the domestic violence organizations on board. People have been writing songs and holding fundraising concerts. And we really could use everybody. We, people can either form local teams or be part of, you know, national work on things we can collaborate through email and phone. And our next plans are, we have several things, getting endorsements of organizations, which really means when we go out and talk to organizations and unions, we're educating a lot of people. And when unions pass resolutions like the longshore workers did in Oakland. They passed a fabulous resolution a week or so ago pledging support to the Justice for Trayvon movement and the call to free Marissa Alexander. This has just a huge impact of adding thousands of people to the movement. So we're working on endorsers, this letter writing campaign to Marissa Alexander, and also if people know of activities in their cities around the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, we're encouraging people to march in solidarity in those actions or participate in those actions and bring together the fact that one of the key fights for freedom and justice today is the fight to free Marissa Alexander.
Wonderful. We have several callers on the line that are backed up, and we're going to give them an opportunity to participate. If other listeners would like to join us, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Good morning, Sheila. Welcome
to
Cable.
Well, Joanne, I have a question, not a comment.
Right.
I heard, well, I guess it's a comment. I heard, or I read online that she had gone out and got, she had walked out of, or left the, her husband and got, left and got a gun and came back. Is that true? And if that's the case, I think that's why she got such a harsh sentence.
Well, even her husband's words were, she did go to the garage, which was, I from what I've read, and I wasn't there, from what I've read, she went to the garage, got her gun out of the glove compartment. Her husband's testimony said he knew she couldn't leave because the garage was locked. So even going into the garage, into the automobile, at that point, she was not able to leave the property. And so she did get the gun. She went back in the house, and she shot the gun into the ceiling.
Well, how did she get it if it was locked?
The garage was locked so that she couldn't move the car, but she got the gun out of the glove compartment.
And why couldn't she leave the property?
All I know is what I've read. And
yeah,
again,
I mean, it makes sense that if
right?
she got out of the house...
Well, it doesn't, I don't know. Was the house attached to the garage?
A,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, many households, right? You go in the garage, you can go right into the house. So I don't know, but I can tell you what I've read. But I just think the interesting thing about this case is that there was a restraining order filed with the state. So it wasn't like, you know, this wasn't, there wasn't a history already there. But
yeah, he
but anyway,
shouldn't even have been there then.
Exactly, right.
But yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that she should be in jail.
No,
and
I understand
by any means.
Right, right.
But I don't understand why she did. If she could get out of the house into the garage, and maybe she could. Maybe there was. I don't understand why she couldn't have just left the house. That's
well, there's a lot of good information online. There's a lot of news articles because I did a lot of research before I scheduled this show.
Yeah.
And so you can certainly find a lot of information online. But I think
that would be okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Helen, did you want to respond? I'm sorry. I...
No, I think you responded very well and clearly. And that, I mean, without knowing all the details
right.
and specifics,
right.
I haven't seen the house either.
Right.
I mean, the thing that we do know is Marissa felt she was trapped.
Right.
And that she could not leave the house and because of being the garage being not an escape route and
right.
and her husband was blocking her ability to leave and threatening her life.
Well,
and I think one thing that's really important for us to think about because there are there's people out there saying, well, what about there were kids in the house? Her husband's
two sons, right,
were in the house, and people are saying Marissa endangered those children, and by firing the shot, it's very actually unclear whether both of those kids were in the house. So there's a lot of details we don't know the full information.
That's right.
But to think about, I mean, what about the attacker's impact on those children?
Right.
What about him showing them a man physically abusing and threatening the life of their stepmother?
Right.
I mean, this is the person who I think is at fault.
Well, and this is a man who said he's got, he had five girlfriends and he beat them all except one.
Mm-hmm.
and this is in his own testimony. He's always admitted that he was the aggressor. And here's what I find interesting. Here's a man who, by all accounts, is not a man to be proud of, but he was honest when he went to court and said, I'm an aggressor. I beat women. I beat most of the women I've been involved with. And yet the court decided to disregard his testimony because they felt he was trying to protect Marissa.
Yeah, that makes no sense. I mean, because that was sworn testimony in a lot of detail. And then at some other point, obviously somebody told him that wasn't a very good thing to put out in public. And he said, oh, well, that was a lie. Well, even that doesn't give him a lot of credibility.
Exactly. So to me, the 12 minutes from going into the jury room into the verdict, all of that adds up to clearly this was not a fair trial in anybody's stretch of the imagination.
Right.
So I guess we'll go back to the phone line. And we will see who else is calling us. And if you are just joining us, I am talking to Helen Gilbert. She is part of the leadership team on the Free Marissa Now campaign. She also serves as the organizer, the Seattle organizer for Radical Women, which is a national multiracial socialist feminist organization that fights for women's rights and social justice. We are going to go back to the phone line. Hello, David. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. I'm glad you're running this show. There were two different questions I'd want to ask about this.
All right.
First of all, I understand that Trayvon Martin's prosecutor, or the prosecutor in the Trayvon Martin case, was the same prosecutor that managed this case.
That's correct.
And so I'm just wondering if there's any... certainly after the verdict of Zimmerman, there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not he really threw the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether or not this case was handled so badly that it was seen as a mismanagement of it as well. And the second question had to do with whether or not Florida has privatized prisons.
Right.
It's my understanding that these privatized prisons are demanding that they keep a capacity. In other words, they don't make any money unless the jails are full.
That's right.
And so to give her 20 years is a guarantee that they're going to keep that prison full. And whether or not privatized prisons have some factor in this.
I thank you for bringing up the whole issue of private prisons and for-profit prisons. Is that true in Florida, that the prison population is in private, for-profit prisons? Helen?
That is an excellent question, and I'll have to find that out. I mean, I do know nationally that the issue of privatized prisons, I think, has certainly been leading to the institution of mandatory minimum sentencing and all kinds of pro-prison solutions, because there is a profit to be made,
right,
by exploiting these prisoners. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are privatized prisons in Florida, but I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you just saying you don't know, and I don't know either, but I'm going to look it up. I'll know soon. But I appreciate David bringing that up, because that has been another huge growth industry. And as Michelle Alexander says, and so we have confirmed that Florida does have, in fact, private for-profit prisons. And so one of the things that Michelle Alexander wrote in her book, The New Jim Crow, Colorblindness in the Age I'm forgetting the subtitle. But anyway, Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, what she talks about is how intentional the development of these systems are, right? Starting with the Reagan days, about just not even talking about color, but just using crime as a euphemism for for black people and for incarcerating black people. So there's becoming more of an awareness of the interconnectedness of these issues.
And yeah. Well, and that gets into whether or not the prosecutor has shares in the privatized prison. I used to live in Colorado, this is over 20 years ago, and they were getting these privatized prisons all over the state, and it became a method of political power.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of the prosecutors in downtown Denver was sending prisoners out to a privatized prison 250 miles away, and he would, these were very, very poor counties, way out near Arizona, Utah, the Four Corners area. And he wanted, this prosecutor wanted to run for governor.
Right.
And so by sending jobs, so to speak, by sending prisoners out that far away, and these are people that weren't murderers and all sorts of things. I mean, they were basically parking ticket, you know,
right.
Also, you know, marijuana cases, all sorts of things. And if their family wanted to visit them, they had to go basically 500 miles just to visit for a couple of hours on a weekend.
Wow.
And they had to stay at motels. They had to do all of the expenses of traveling that far just to visit somebody on a local, basically what you would call a municipal crime.
Right.
But the idea that they, this was privatized within the state.
Right.
Nowadays, they're getting into these privatized prisons where I'm calling you from California,
right.
And they're actually trying to send, Jerry Brown has at least pulled back on this one, but they were sending California prisoners all the way to Texas.
Oh, and, yes, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, and very costly, plus it's a violation of due process,
right.
In that your family and attorney can't even
communicate
with you,
right.
Yeah, except by extreme cost.
Well, thank you so much for
sure.
Your call. We're going to have to move on. Thank you so much for listening from California. We love that.
Yeah, thanks for the show.
Thank you. Have a great day. Helen, you wanted to jump in, and David jumped in first. Did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole problem of privatized prisons, speaking as a radical women member, you know, it's part of the whole problem of a society that runs for the sake of profit in general.
Right.
I think workplace discrimination,
mm-hmm.
The gross underpayment of people of color and women benefit the huge rich corporations and employers, and these divide and conquer of racism and sexism, the cutbacks in social services are all part of keeping the capitalist system healthy, the rich
That's
richer
right.
than ever before, while those of us who work for a living are just scrambling to survive.
Absolutely.
And I think this is part of a whole attempt to push us back that we are resisting.
Absolutely true. And I wanted to add, Helen, just in case folks in Oregon are getting smug because we don't have private prisons, I want to remind them that though we don't have private prisons, what we do have is for-profit corporations inside the prison where inmates are required to work 40 hours a week. Many of the jobs inside the prison were family wage, living wage, community jobs before we created the enterprise inside that now allows corporations to profit off of prison labor. And so don't get smug, Oregon. We don't have private prisons, but we are still using prisoners pretty much as slave labor so that some corporations can make a profit.
Yeah. Someone just handed me some information here, too. This is about the private prisons in Florida and the governor of Florida, who has just allowed a private prison company to take over prisons that will cut 1,700 public workers. And the article points out that the governor has received more than $100,000 in political contributions from private prison companies.
But of course, that didn't influence his political decision at all, did it?
Of course.
No, not. We know that doesn't happen because they were above that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ah, well, thank you for that information. We got a couple of callers on the line. If you want to join us, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, Georgiana. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thank you. Good
You're
morning.
You're welcome. Good morning.
This is an excellent program, and I'm so glad that Marissa's case is getting the kind of attention that it has been. I mean, it's been building, which is so important.
Yes, it is.
It really reminded me of, I had a couple of thoughts. It reminds me a lot of her fighting up and standing up against being attacked. Reminds me of the history of black women in general in this country,
mm-hmm.
of organizing to fight back against sexual abuse,
mm-hmm.
and how that actually created the infrastructure that was able to launch the civil rights movement in this country. And I think that there is, you know, a lot of history of the role of, specifically the role of black women in the United States, that this really is an also an opportunity to shine a light on that, because it's quite a heroic and very important struggle that a lot of people owe freedoms to, that kind of goes unacknowledged, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there you were talking earlier about how all of these attacks are able to happen. And what struck me is that when you don't really have a strong movement,
mm-hmm.
you know, a strong feminist movement, a strong civil rights movement, that's when this crap really starts to escalate.
That's right.
And, you know, I'm just thinking that one of the things that we really need, you know, as organizers in the community, I mean, I'm the organizer of the Freedom Socialist Party, a sister organization of radical women here in Portland, is the real need of resuscitating or strengthening a civil rights and a feminist movement. It seems like that's really something that, I mean, we're just going to see more attacks and deeper
divisions.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of strong, you know, harder hardships, I guess,
right.
And
mm-hmm.
you know, the rise of I mean, if you're of color and a woman and gay, or an immigrant, I mean, you are in the crosshairs of this system that just basically wants to increase the brutalization of those on the bottom. But that's also where the fuel of a movement to really take back our lives and create a world of peace and abundance, that's where the power is, which I think is also why those are the people who are also filling up the prisons.
Yes. Very excellent points. Thank you so much for your...
Yeah, thank you very much for the program, and I'm interested to hear other people's comments.
Yeah, as am I. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And since you're in Portland, I should let you know that there is a campaign to end the new Jim Crow group that meets in Portland and will meet this Saturday from 11 to 1 at PCC Cascade, second floor, room 204 of the Student Center. And we've been working pretty closely with the socialist organization here, around the new Jim Crow efforts. So thank you for your work, and hopefully we'll continue to work together to build this movement that we so desperately need. And so I want to go back to Helen, and Helen, are we at a good time? I mean, are we at a time where women and people of color can organize a movement that people are going to be supporting? I know that you're doing a great job around the Free Marissa Now campaign, but the bigger movement, the bigger issue, the issues that we've been talking about today, are we primed for a movement now?
I think the need is certainly there, mm-hmm. and people are coming forward on cases like Marissa's and Trayvon Martin's.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's going to take a huge mass movement to win freedom for Marissa. In my personal opinion as radical women, what I think it's going to take to make this movement come together and stay together and you know, move forward long range is one ingredient we need to do is stop relying on the Democratic Party in particular and other parties that don't really challenge the system.
Amen. Amen. Boy, Helen, you're my sister from another mother, because that's my story all the time. It's like it hasn't really mattered to the African-American community whether Democrats or Republicans have been in office, because at the end of the day, if you look at outcomes, we are very close. August 28th will be the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. The top issues on August 28th, 1963, was jobs, police brutality, health care, education, housing. Guess what the issues are today, if you talk to African-American community? The exact same ones, I would say, in the exact same order as they've been for 50 years. And so as a longtime activist, that kind of saddens my heart to think, you know, 50 years ago, people were marching for these exact same issues, and we've gone so far back. And so my question to you, Helen, is, have we gone so far back because we had the audacity to elect a black president?
Well, there's a certain element there where people haven't wanted to. I think they've put up with policies coming down from the White House that would have caused huge protest in the streets if it had been a Republican in office doing the same measures.
Right.
And, you know, I've seen that happen in Washington State also, where there's too much lenience, that it's better to have a Democrat do you wrong than a Republican, when the fact is they're doing you wrong. And we need to be independent, and we need to organize in our own defense and not rely on politicians who are making deals with who represent the power structure, and not rely on sort of specialists and NGOs. It's the thing that was powerful in the 60s and 70s. These were mass movements where people were organizing and speaking out for themselves.
That's right. Excellent. Well, I'm going to let listeners know what's coming up today on KBOO. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, The News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Chris Nelder, the energy writer for Smart Planet Newsletter, talks about oil reserves in the U.S. At 10 on Flashpoint, writer Norman Solomon talks about a petition in support of awarding the Nobel Peace Prize to Bradley Manning. We also have a report on how Dreamers and their supporters were attacked at the U.S./Mexican border. At 11 on Between the Covers, author George Packer discusses his latest book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. At 11:30 on Black Book Talk, Dr. Earl Bracey talks about the book Too Young to Die, Inner-City Adolescents' Homicides, and the Making of a Psychologist. Thanks, Cable members, for your support of Community Radio. If you're not a member, go online to kboo.fm, click the tip jar, and become a member that way. And so I want to, again, just thank you so much for providing us such a wealth of information, Helen. I want to give you an opportunity again to tell us about the Facebook page, website, upcoming activities. And before you do that, is there going to be an effort connected with the 50th anniversary March on Washington? That's because you talked about local efforts, but are you also connected to the Washington, D.C. effort?
The people in there's people in the group who are taking part in Seattle. There's March on Washington observance that's very, very making the connection to the Marissa Alexander case. It's put on by the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists in Washington, D.C. I know many, many people are coming from around the East Coast to participate in those demonstrations, including people working on Marissa's case.
Wonderful.
And on the 28th of August, there's the Southern Freedom Movement is doing marches in all the southern state capitals to draw these issues together.
Wonderful.
And I do think, I mean, that we can make change. You know, we need to do what the people in Greece, Egypt, or Spain are doing, which is go out on the streets, say enough is enough. We're going to make this system serve us. And, you know, this is what a revolution is. Maybe we need to change the system from one that's thriving on our abuse to one that where we are making the decisions and making it serve those who do the work and make the country run.
That you are absolutely right. It is an ideal time for people to be involved, making sure that we're building the kind of country we want to live in. It is kind of ironic to think that 50 years ago, people were willing to put it all on the line. And so the question becomes, what will it take for this generation to be willing to put it all on the line? I want to thank you so much for the work that you do, raising the issue of domestic violence and raising the issue about how laws that are supposed to protect us are ultimately used against us in what's supposed to be our court system. We have another caller on the line. Hello, Eddie. We're going to squeak you in at the very end. How are you today?
Pretty good. I'm calling from Montana.
Ah, thanks for calling from Montana. All right.
Here's what I want to say. I think that if you want to change the world and have a revolution, you really got to find something in the world that really bothers you, and then find that corollary within yourself, and then cleanse yourself from that thing, because that's where the education is. For instance, we're talking about all these issues without really talking about some major issues, which is unity.
Hmm.
You know, we're not going to go anywhere without unity. And right now you have all these groups.
Hmm.
And I'm talking, you know, there are toothless hillbilly groups in Oregon, because I'm from Eastern Oregon, that number in the thousands that are allies of, they don't know who.
Right.
If there's no unity.
Hmm.
And so they know they don't want to get dragged into that across the border Idaho, Montana Republican war thing. But at the same time, there's no unity in Oregon because everybody hasn't taken that revolution to heart. And by this, I mean like this. There's an elitism there. There's an elitism in Oregon that I had to leave because in Portland there was 18 people in 3 years that have autism like I do, shot and killed by the police.
Mm.
And the only response to it is everybody working through the system. Well, the system says right in it, when the government fails to serve the people's needs, you can abolish it.
Mm-hmm.
It says that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're not even beginning to go there because it's kind of like, when I moved here, I moved from Oregon, which is a progressive state, so I was treated a little bit good by everybody that wasn't, you know, the police law enforcement community. Everybody else was pretty conceptually free with me there because the ADA is law. People do have to follow federal law to get their funding. The city, state, and county governments all follow the law. I moved over here to Montana, and the same thing is happening here on a smaller level to me that I see happening back in Oregon, which is if you really want to get radical, you want to find the kind of elitism, the kind of streamlining and conformity issues that we're complaining about in our own groups, in our own areas where we're eliminating the alliances with people who don't fall into our judgment or don't make us comfortable. It's a very convenient society anymore, and without really testing yourself to find out if you're comfortable or not, people will, and I'm from Portland, you know, I worked up there a lot, I know people will fall back into whatever's comfortable.
Well, you know, Portland, you know, is one of those kind of places we pat ourselves on the back about how progressive we are, but yet we're only progressive if you look like you're white, middle-class, male, you know.
Well, there's a million subgenders. If you're at La Luna on a punk night,
right,
you got to have a mohawk and pierced head. If you're at Capo, you have to speak in a certain tone. You know, you can't be an intense autistic individual and get very far there.
Well, right. But my point is that we live in this self-delusion here in Oregon. We tell ourselves we're progressive. But as you mentioned, when you get unarmed people shot and killed by the police, and people just go, oh, how tragic, and just kind of walk off and go back to their life, there's something wrong with that.
Well, like, for instance, I see the solution you guys have there about homelessness. You guys are on the cutting edge a lot of times. Eugene and Seattle and Portland have experimental models, and they have things going on that people do that create a solutions to it. But the problem with it all is that there's this unity that's lacking there. There are Christians. There are common people. There are atheists who have jobs and who work but are kind people who, along with many of the people in the counterculture communities and many of the people in the minority communities and many of the women's community and gay rights and disabled communities, who would ally together to go and spend time in their own food banks as customers, in their own shelters as customers, in their own, you have to go through the processes, because here's what happens in Portland a lot, and it happens and I miss it. Okay, I miss it here because
if you can get this out in 30 seconds, because our program is just about up, you got
it.
Got to cut it.
Here's how it is: if you go and you put yourself in the place of those who are unable to do so, then you create unity, and that's where community comes from. It comes from actually being down in the ditches, and that's what the people can do if they want to go mix it up on the street level like that. If you want to do what you guys are doing, I think you guys' energy should be utilized
neighborhood. I'm sorry. Thank you very much. We got to end that. Helen, I am so sorry. We ran out of time, but we'll bring you back for sure. I'm Joanne Hardesty. You've been listening to Voices from the Edge. Thank you so much for listening. Have a fabulous day.
Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is cold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on, get up.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, just about 9 o'clock on this Thursday morning. Coming up in a half hour at 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fogering speaks with Chris Nelder, the energy writer for Smart Planet Newsletter on oil reserves in the U.S. At 10 o'clock today on Flashpoints, writer Norman Solomon talks about a petition in support of awarding the Nobel Peace Prize to Bradley Manning. We also have a report on how dreamers and their supporters were attacked at the U.S.-Mexico border. And more on Precious Knowledge, a documentary about the movement to save ethnic studies programs in Arizona schools. At 11 o'clock this morning on Between the Covers, author George Packers discusses his latest book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. At 11:30 on Black Book Talk, Dr. Earl Bracey talks about his book, Too Young to Die, Inner City Adolescent Homicides and the Making of a Psychologist. That's all coming up this morning on The Mighty Boo. But coming up next, stick around for Teresa Mitchell. She's hosting Press Watch with the news you're not supposed to know. And that's right here on KBOO.
Slip a bookmark into your paperback and listen to KBOO for interviews with your favorite fiction and nonfiction writers. Between the Covers airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.